my favorite song ever. Blessed Assurance. Blessed Assurance, we thought was quite appropriate for today because while it looked like there wasn't enough, there was. There was. I wrote a sermon today, and I have it here, but I don't like it. I like the one we just had better, actually. And what I'm learning as I prepare each week, that it is the story for all ages that actually reveals what we need to hear in the text. I can run off in lots of different directions. But now, you may remember that last week when we left here, Jesus and his disciples were resting. Remember? They were resting. They had gone away to a place to be quiet after all of their travels in the world, and the disciples had come back to tell about all that they had seen and done and taught and the wonders they'd performed. And Jesus said to them, come away, rest a while. The rest didn't last long. And that text in the Gospel of Mark, which we have been following over these weeks, led right into the story of the feeding of the 5,000. So when I left here last week, I was all excited about the story of the feeding of the 5,000. We get to preach that this Sunday. And wouldn't you know it, the lectionary switched us from the Gospel of Mark feeding to the Gospel of John feeding. And while they're very similar, they are not the same. The thing that was missing, the crucial thing that was missing, was this one line in the Gospel of Mark. It turns out it's the same line in all the other three Gospels, not in John. The line is, when we see the 5,000 there, it's time for supper, time to eat, what are we going to do? Jesus says to the disciples, you give them something to eat. You do it. You guys have been out teaching and preaching, doing what I do. You give them something to eat. I never hear that particular line, and I'm always associating it with the feeding of the 5,000 because of my mother told me it was important. She's the one who pointed out to me that in the synoptic text, the three that look alike, those gospels all say, you give them something to eat. Now, I don't know why John has to be different, but is. So I get to the John text and I'm waiting, wait a minute, hold it. I already know what this says, right? And then my line is missing. My line is missing. Well, I wanted to know why, and so I went to look. I went to the commentaries to suggest what purpose there might have been that John, or the writer of John, might have had in leaving that out. As you'll remember, and of course you're going to go home and look at this, right, after church and all during the week, you're going to look at this reading from John and you're going to say, no, in this gospel, it is Jesus who says, what are we going to do? It's time for them to eat. And then it says, he said this to test them. He knew exactly what he was going to do. And then as the story unfolds, it's Jesus who feeds the 5,000. Not so in Mark, not so in the other Gospels. John comes to write his account of what happened in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus at a time when it was important, very important, that this doer of wonders and signs, the one that all these 5,000 and more people came to see, actually did them, those signs, those miracles could be witnessed, and people would believe. They would believe that God sent this one, and they would believe and trust that God would provide. Slightly different. So I'm thinking, what's our need in the story of the 5,000. By the way, there are feedings like this, we call them miracle stories, throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. So, what do we need, this church, this gathering of whatever number we are on this hillside, what do we need? Do we need to be inspired or encouraged to trust and believe in God? Or do we need to know what Jesus wanted to know? You give them something to eat. They're hungry. It's time. What are you going to do? If Jesus says that to us right now, it's, what are you going to do? You give them something to eat. You hold a sick person's hand. You smile at someone who looks like they are having a really bad day. You give that person in the pew next to you just the teeniest bit of grace. Notice them and imagine you know and can read in their body language some sort of need that just your presence can answer. What are you gonna do? So, John's description of what happened was created, if you will, was designed for a certain world. So was the gospel that we attribute to John. What gospel we need today believe beyond what you can see. So I kind of wrestled with these passages, looking for a word for this congregation on this hillside. And because I wrestled with them, I found new lessons. New lessons for me and new lessons for the church today. The first thing I learned was that I had assumed I already knew what it said. Well, of course I knew what it said. I've preached it many times. You know what it said. You've heard this story 100 times at least. It was not so true. I did not know everything this passage had to teach me. In fact, I've just learned one thing standing here before you, but I'll talk about that later. Actually, I don't have to talk about it. You've just heard it. My presuppositions about Mark's version of the story were written all over everything I could see or hear in John's. There weren't any questions in either of them that I couldn't already answer. And then, of course, there was my mother's voice, right, telling me this is the important, telling me this is the important line, my mother, long deceased, who speaks in my head from time to time, giving it an emotional overlay that I was not aware of, an important emotional overlay. And then in a conversation with one of the members of this church this week, I remembered something, actually, I remembered that I forgot to do something that I'm supposed to do that I actually teach. And that is a kind of quick and easy, I think responsible way to do exegesis, to explore these texts without telling them what they say already, which is easy to do. The first step, it's two steps. First, it's see what you see. That's it. Just see it. You don't have a comment on it. Nothing. You see it, maybe even you don't see it. The second step is then separate from that, you begin to look at the emotional overlays or what the senses in the text tell you. They're two different steps, not one. I'd forgotten to do that. Knowing everything about this story, going in, made it really easy for me not to have to wrestle too much or struggle too much to find a word of good news for today. Gospel meaning good news. And that's my job, isn't it? My job, as I understand it, is to stand before you on a Sunday and proclaim a word of good news. As my father says, if it's not good news, you need to sit down and be very quiet. It's good news. Sometimes you have to wrestle for it. Sometimes the lectionary is as mute as a mummy on what it wants to say until about the fifth day in. And in the silence, or from the silence, comes this something, a picture, an idea, an inspiration, if you will. And that's actually my job. My work in preparing a sermon is to find a word of good news to proclaim to God's people in this time, in this place. And there is, finally, good news. Towards the end of my wrestling, actually it got closer to Sunday and there was no more wrestling to be done, I began to read both of the versions together. John tells us Jesus knew what he was going to do about the shortage of food, and he tested the disciples on what they made of it. And Mark tells us that his test, if you will, was to ask them, or to say to them, you give them something to eat. That's what's needed here. No test, you don't have to look around. You give them something to eat. Mark has Jesus looking for a response in action. Words not needed. A response in action. Mark has Jesus calling them to faith and action. John has us looking only at what Jesus does, because for John, that's more important. For us, I think the question is always, what will we do? What ought we do? So together, John and Mark tell us Jesus knows what he can do, and they tell us Jesus wants to see what we can do, what we will do. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I looked over at Joyce Myers Brown. I'm driving through, I'm on Peachtree Road, Peachtree Street, Midtown, driving past Colony Square. And out of the corner of my eye, I hear these loud voices screaming and people waving banners. Who's in the front of the group? Who do you think? Well, Jesus wanted to know what we would do, and Joyce had an answer. And all the people who were with her, and I can't for the life of me remember what the cause was, but you needed to speak out, right? I couldn't help, I'm sorry. But it's the answer to the question, what are you going to do? You're going to stand on the corner of 14th and Peachtree, and you're going to wave a sign. We typically call this a miracle story. I don't think so. Well, today I'm not wanting to think so. I'm reading it as a wonder story. A wonder story. Certainly a wonder occurred. It's not a miracle story. It's easy to think of miracle stories that we find in the Bible as things that people did a long time ago. And of course, Jesus can do miracles. He's Jesus, for goodness sake. Can we do miracles? Ah, a question. It is truly a wonder that so many people ate their full of so little and had so much left over. But the wonder is more in the disciples and the people's response to the situation. Our response. What happens if you don't have enough to share, to go around? You have to share. You have to share. What we want to do about it when Jesus asks us what we are going to do is, it's a wonder. And what is also a wonder, and I'll tell you this quite frankly, God is still expecting us to do something. There are people who think that God had a second plan, but no. We're it. Okay, so the wonder is the good that they were able to do, that they were able to make happen, the hunger they were able to correct, to ease, the neighbor love they were able to incite in that moment. That's a wonder. Sitting on that hill, something happened, driving down Peachtree Street, something happened. It's a wonder. It's a wonder, Marion, who may be gone. Marion, last week, there were for some reason, things from the children's space had disappeared. Marion was devastated, and I was too. And then she discovered one day this week that at the bottom of the stairs, all the things that were missing were stored in reserve, just like my picnic basket. We had enough. Of course, those people had food with them. They'd come a long way. They were traveling. They weren't looking for McDonald's or the supermarket on the way. They brought things with, anyhow. The best part of the story for me, well, no. There are things that the story leaves out. They look at, when they're looking at the courses of action, I love this, Andrew says, there's a kid over there with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, what the text doesn't tell you is the pause where they are looking at him like he'd lost his mind. It's like, Andrew, really? Seriously? What the miracle stories don't show us is that following that child's example, that little one's example, everyone begins to share and discover the abundance and assurance of God's love. The wonder is that now, in this story, in Mark's story, we see the disciples move through the crowd, distributing, collecting, making sure people had what was needed. The call to action, or the call to faith, followed by the call to action. The call to faith, beyond what we can see. That same Jesus stands before us right now, on this hillside, inviting us to respond in trust and faithful obedience. As one commentator said, this same Jesus invites us to trust his mighty power and abundant blessing. For his gracious power exceeds far more than the miracles of the Old Testament or even the New Testament can suggest. Trust in the power and assurance of God's grace, God's
Mm-hmm.
love, and God's abundant blessing can do wonders, even now. And that is good news, very good news. Amen.